Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last time we were talking about the English Civil War, and I started to discuss the extent to which there was a reaction after the Civil War. And I pointed out that one of the effects of the reaction was that the change of the franchise in 1653, when separate representation had been given, for example, to Bradford, Leeds, and Manchester, all of these lost their separate parliamentary seats under Charles II. That doesn't mean the people there couldn't vote, because they could still all vote for the Yorkshire and Lancashire county representation, but it meant they didn't have a separate representation. In contrast, the poorly populated so-called rotten boroughs, who had lost their seats in 1653, regained them. And it's worth noting that Daniel Defoe, a nonconformist, commented on the consequences in his tour around the country, which was published in the mid-1720s, and which reflected both his experiences travelling around the country, but also his role as an electoral agent for Robert Harley. And he wrote, for example, of Castle Rising in Norfolk, an old decayed borough town with perhaps not 10 families in it, which yet sends 2 members to the British Parliament, being as many as the city of Norwich itself. Now, I'm not discussing the rights and wrongs of representation under our present system, but it's certainly instructive to note the nature of it in the late 17th century. And indeed, Defoe made similar comments about Queensborough, about Winchelsea, about Gatton, Bletchingley, Old Sarum, Boroughbridge, Aldborough, and the entire southwest, which was heavily overrepresented, particularly Cornwall. Separately, a 1702 pamphlet drew on political arithmetic, again, something that people these days are interested in. It was called the title. People loved long titles for pamphlets. The representation of London and Westminster in Parliament examined and considered, wherein appears the antiquity of most of the boroughs in England, with the proportions whereby each county is over or under represented according to a scale from the Royal Aid Assessments, by which it appears that Middlesex is found to be represented but 1/10 part of its due. So the sort of similar comments that have been repeatedly made about overrepresentation of Scotland and Wales, for example. In another reaction under Charles II, printing and the supply of paper were strictly limited to the master printers of the Stationers' Company of London and the University of Printers, which was a way of dealing with the issue of, trying to control the press. While the 1661 Act for, quote, the well-governing and regulating of corporations allowed the king to purge boroughs of those regarded as disaffected. Local commissioners were supposed to get borough officials to take the oaths of supremacy and allegiance and to remove the unwilling or those who were willing if they saw it as expedient for the public safety to do so. That is, the commissioners seeing it as expedient to get rid of them. In Gloucester, about 3/4 of the corporation's members were purged, although most in practice had been willing to take the oaths. 13 of the 24 burgesses of Tewkesbury were purged in 1662. And of course, this very much affected the election of MPs. And the imposition of an Anglican order was progressively tightened, with worship not in accordance with Anglican rites forbidden, and the 5 Mile Act of 1665 prohibiting dissenting ministers from living within 5 miles of any corporate town or place in which they had served prior to the Act. In turn, under Charles II, who in fact was king from 1660 to 85, and his brother James II, 1685 to 1688, don't want to offend Scots, he's James VII of Scotland, there were continued political divisions that affected urban politics and governance. And this was linked to cultural issues, notably architectural patronage, to civic plans and to projects. So, you know, if something was envisaged, it would be seen as either pro-governmental or maybe a throwback to the Puritans and the interregnum. And political conflicts, for example, in Pontefractum in Yorkshire, on which work has been done, were shaped by memories of war and deep-rooted religious differences. So you can see this in the town of Arundel in Sussex. In 1586, in Elizabeth's reign, as a result of a royal charter, the corporation there had obtained some independence from its manorial lord. Now, this corporation was dominated by a Presbyterian group during the Civil War and the Interregnum. It was removed from power after Charles II's Corporation Act, I've already referred to, but then returned after a legal judgment in 1677. More generally, in the early 1680s, in the Tory years of the last years of his reign, Charles resorted to encouraging the excommunication of dissenters to deny them the vote in borough elections. There was also an attack on Whig strongholds in which corporation charters, such as those of Norwich in 1682, were remodeled in order to increase the influence of the crown. While in 1683, the Charter of London was forfeited because its council wouldn't accept remodelling. As a result, London's government was brought under direct royal control. And this was a precursor to the attack on municipal independence in the 1980s. Obviously, the contexts were different. Margaret Thatcher was scarcely Charles II. But nevertheless, it's interesting to see the both occurring. The remodelling as well of the London livery companies in the 1680s was part of a process of purge and counter-purge that fueled long-lasting divisions and also helped create an institutional paralysis in the City of London that eased the acceptance of the Glorious Revolution of 1688 to 89. Although it's worth bearing in mind that political variations didn't necessarily mean differences in means of addressing urban problems. So in some towns, political differences, bang, that causes problems for everything. In other points, you know, there's a success of handling civic differences. So Winchester, for example, civic cohesion and conservative non-partisan continuity made a success of self-government. The limited ability of central government to create amenable local elites emerged there and elsewhere. Again, in Norwich, on a long-standing pattern, the civic elite sought to limit division by relying on a shared sociability, a moderation in politics, and an emphasis on loyalty to the town and its constitution. Indeed, there and elsewhere, many of those who were most divisive in individual towns came from outside the elite, offering a different politics. Nevertheless, again, changes in personnel could be significant, and these tended to reflect actions by central government, purging boroughs in particular. And these actions were intended to influence municipal politics, and what a surprise they did. Yet once a core group of activists existed in a borough, it generated its own momentum, helping to split towns both politically and in religious terms, for example, Bedford. But also, these core group of activists could serve to limit or at least hinder royal action. Now, in 1688, you have the Glorious Revolution against James II that sees not only William of Orange, later William III, of course, and an invading Dutch army overthrow James, but also a Whig seizure of power in many towns, either by the army as it advanced. You know, first major town it rolled through was Exeter, because it landed in Brixham, or other towns which were seized by supporters or would-be supporters of the change. The Glorious Revolution was followed by what was known as the Revolution Settlement, which was a product, a classification, and a cause of a new political, governmental, religious, financial, economic, and cultural settlement. One aspect was a change in regulation that had a major impact on the situation between towns and also within them. London monopolies were felled, for example, that of the London Guild of Distillers in 1690. These our monopolies had often been very close to figures at court. They had gained advantage accordingly. And again, in case you think that this is some quaint thing that happened in the past, I mean, think, for example, of, I don't know, Peter Mandelson under Tony Blair or David Cameron and Greensill. You know, we have exactly the same process today. And one of the effects of the Glorious Revolution was to turn against these monopolies. More generally, guilds ceased to be so relevant, and their ordinances and bylaws, which had sought to maintain their power and role, became increasingly redundant. Indeed, by the mid-18th century, most guild regulations would have become of largely antiquarian interest. And you know, the extent to which modern livery companies, such as the Merchant Tailors in London or the Tuckers in Exeter, are charitable clubs rather than governing bodies for particular trades, reflect the earlier collapse of the guilds as well as more general economic change. Moreover, within towns, the dominant position of the Church of England was weakened, often greatly so, as a result of the Revolution Settlement. The Revolution Settlement eased the legal position of dissenters. After political change imposed from outside, the other major problem for towns was that of fire. Most famously, of course, London in 1666, the Great Fire, but also elsewhere. Tiverton, Wyndham, Northampton, and Warwick being hard hit, for example, in 1612, 1615, 1675, and 1694, respectively. Daniel Defoe noted of Alresford, which had a destructive fire in 1689, that, quote, by a sudden and surprising fire, the whole town, with both the church and the market house, was reduced to a heap of rubbish. And except a few poor huts at the remotest end of the town, not a house left standing. There was another bad fire there in 1736, which began in a brewery. People these days obviously make fun often of health and safety regulations, but those regulations were certainly very necessary for dealing with issues of sanitation and fire in the 17th century. Wood and thatch burned readily. Population growth, poorly regulated building, and the intermixing of manufacturing and commerce with accommodation all provided problems. Moreover, firefighting faced many limitations. Nevertheless, the Rebuilding Acts of Parliament for London acted as the model for large-scale building across the country, notably the stipulations against projecting windows and in favour of brick. And that was seen, for example, in Northampton, which had its major fire only 9 years after London. Parliamentary legislation provided also authority for the Warwick Fire Commissioners, whose authority, so the fire there was in 1694, they were given, as it were, exceptional local powers. Think about, for example, like the Docklands Corporation in London in the 1980s. And they dictated style and encouraged both rebuilding and the widening of streets in Warwick. And this process speeded up a more general change in building materials, obviously in towns that had had fires, but also more generally away from timber and towards brick, tar, and tile. Now, there was also a pronounced social dimension to building materials. John Evelyn, not the famous diarist, reporting in 1702 that, quote, Truro is a pretty neat town built of stone and covered with slate. as most of the houses in this county, that's Cornwall, are, excepting those belonging to the poor sort, which generally consist of mud walls covered with thatch. The Great Fire of London also encouraged the taking out of insurance policies, both in London and elsewhere. The resulting creation of fire insurance companies provided new links between London and other towns, because they tended to be based in London, as well as records on urban life and values, occupational profiles and building usage that are of considerable value today. The British Mercury, for example, it's a newspaper of the 4th of February 1713, reported that a serious fire in Whitefriars in London was tackled by 25, quote, firemen belonging to the Sun Fire Office and some few of other fire officers. Obviously, you read that account, you would know that it would be a good idea to get your policy with the Sun Fire Office. In Defoe's novel, Moll Flanders finds, quote, so many engines playing when there was a fire. That's fire engines pumping water, and this, of course, provides her with an opportunity for pickpocketing. At the same time, social access to insurance varied greatly, which was part of the way in which the risk of fire, as it were, to use a modern jargon, structured and reflected urban societies. Meanwhile, defensive considerations and fortifications explain the purpose or the shape of towns. And this was very much seen in the rebuilding of towns damaged by fire, such as London, the opportunity, or the others I've mentioned, Warwick, for example. The opportunities were not taken to put in new style fortifications. Now, it's very easy, if you're looking at this period, to offer different emphases in discussion. For example, I read an article on the mortality in Penrith, and it argued that 38% of the children born in Penrith between 1650 and 1700 died before reaching the age of six, which is pretty brutal by any consideration. Moreover, destroying hopes that bubonic plague was already in decline, the rapidly spreading Great Plague of 1665 saw a very significant death. Now, it's true that some of the earlier episodes of plague had, as it were, a greater percentage probably dying. So, for example, the 1636 epidemic had killed over 60,000 people. But 1665 was to see even more slaughtered. As deaths mounted, helped by a long hot summer, red crosses were painted on the doors of the infected houses in a fruitless attempt at isolation. Beginning in April 1665, the Great Plague didn't abate until the November frosts. It saw London's economy ruined, public places were closed, sports banned, a 9 p.m. curfew imposed, and fairs prohibited. Although it's worth bearing in mind that civil society didn't break down during the plague. Indeed, Defoe, who was a child at the time, but whose later account reflected London opinion, praised the ability of the City of London authorities to provide security and sustenance, law and order and food, and by comparison criticised the Crown. Yet there was obviously, we're in the midst of rioting at the present moment. This is the 5th of August. This is being recorded at. As an historian, of course, this is not what anybody wants to hear because this is completely ahistorical. I mean, a historian would tell you that in the 18th century, which is my period, they would have had no real problem with this carry on at the moment. They would have, a magistrate would have read the Riot Act. The rioters wouldn't have dispersed. He would have turned to the officer sat next to him, said, "Sir, do your duty." And the troops would have opened fire, which generally sorted things out. So it's worth bearing in mind that, the authorities in 1665, as indeed in 1666, were able to deal with, i.e. hang, looters, which helped to keep order in the situation. It's certainly true that for the Great Plague, the pressure that the authorities were under meant that it's very difficult to get precise figures. You know, there were of mortality, there was pressure on governance. Although not all deaths would have been from plague, city records indicate that 68,596 people died during the epidemic, but the actual number of deaths is suspected to have exceeded 100,000. The total population in 1665 was probably about 460,000. So 100,000 under 460, you can work it out, it's over 20% mortality, which makes obviously COVID a mere statistical cough. The authorities couldn't keep up as deaths mounted in the long hot summer, and the diarist Samuel Pepys was told by his parish clerk, "There died nine this week, though I've returned but six." Moreover, the recording didn't work well for Quakers or for poor transients. Dead paupers were thrown into large burial pits, such as the one at Tottenham Court Road. Many fled London, including the court, the wealthy, most doctors, and a large number of the parochial clergy. This exodus helped ensure the spread of the plague outside London, both in the southeast and more generally, and hit hard places linked to London, such as Newcastle, which was the provider of its coal. The flight of clergy was a serious issue, as in response to the crisis, many of the churches were thronged, people seeking spiritual guidance, help, consolation. In a classic instance of his partisanship, Defoe made much of this flight, emphasizing that the dissenting clergy stayed and continued to minister to all, including the established church. Whilst a lot of the established clerics, the Church of England, if you like, fled. It's worth pointing out that after the epidemic, there was no let up in legal measures against the dissenters. Now, in practice, this was the last major attack of the plague in England. However, immunity to smallpox, which replaced the plague as the most feared disease, was low. Not least because a virulent strain began to have an effect in the second half of the 17th century. So smallpox rose as a killer. And for example, those figures I gave you for Penrith, many of the children died of smallpox as well as respiratory illnesses. Towns on the whole had quite a number of physicians, and if other medical practitioners were included, there were plenty. But aside from a lack of appropriate treatments for both diseases and their vectors or transmitters, there were also the issues created by living conditions, not least poor sanitation, crowded residences, for example, many people sharing in beds, and a shortage of sufficient food. Infection was a particular problem in the winter because that was the season of indoor life. So, for example, in Alcester, the town of Alcester in Midland Town in 1727 to 30, which was a difficult period health-wise across the country, 21% of the population died. Now, living circumstances were grim for most. In towns such as Frome, poor women and children spun wool in their homes. In Defoe's novel, Moll Flanders, the young Moll is taught to spin worsted, which was the chief industry in Colchester, where she grows up. Yet, despite death rates, there was also, as a result of migration, considerable growth in towns. So, in other words, towns tend to have a negative balance because the death rates are so high, so many children in particular die. But their population is sustained and often expanded as a result of migration in from the countryside, which tends to be healthier because the population there is less crowded. So there was considerable growth in towns, and people came in from the countryside just as they did ordinarily anyway, for work and for market. So we're talking, there's not, as it were, necessarily, I'm going to live for the rest of my life in town. Many people might have come in for temporary jobs or jobs for a year or a training in some kind, an apprenticeship of some type. But there was much more movement in that direction. Towns in the 17th century, I've emphasized the difficulties they had, but it's also worth looking at a more positive account in the late 17th century. Many of them moved from poverty, conflict, and disease to an urban renewal that gathered particular pace from the 1690s and was already in progress before that. And some aspects, indeed, can be seen in some towns almost from the outset of the century. So, Norwich, for example, a major town from the 1660s, recovered from the industrial and commercial depression that had been affecting it. There were also attempts by town authorities to improve the urban environment. So, in 1665, it was ordered in Evesham that all householders place lights in front of their dwellings on pain of a fine, in other words, because otherwise there was no street lighting. In Taunton, the east reach of the town saw redevelopment on the site of the sieges of the 1640s. At the same time, governance, in order to obtain growth and reform, faced problems. I mean, it's also worth bearing in mind, and this is necessary for us thinking about politics today, is that it's easy for somebody to say their politics or their policies equate for with reform or progress. Obviously, that's not how they always think. They always strike everybody. So governance faced a process of discussion and compromise, or overlapping, but also different, downright opposition and avoidance. And the latter two limited both municipal and national initiatives. So there was all sorts of reasons for cross currents, including opposition to building on particular plots, people's anxiety about local competition in work, etc., etc. Journeymen joined together to protect their interest against entrepreneurs and to protect their jobs, etc. And I think it's worth saying that the working practices of urban corporations, as a result, could differ considerably, as could the degree of organizational cohesion in individual towns. Now, I've already mentioned that in the Civil War and prior to that, city walls largely delimited towns, but that many of these were damaged during the war or as a result of political action. What that meant was to create more opportunities for building in the civil space. And anyway, even if the walls continued, there were still opportunities for significant buildings within town. So in Newcastle, there was the rebuilding of the Guildhall and the Exchange between 1644 and 48, and the new Mansion House in 1691. Newcastle itself was wealthy. It shipped local coal to London, and using that coal produced about 40% of all the glass made in England in the 17th century. And the availability of coal as a basic heat source that was more reliable and more easily controlled than wood and had higher calorific value was more generally significant. So in Defoe's novel Colonel Jack, which appeared in 1722, the young boys find warmth in the smouldering ashes resulting from coal-fired glass production in London. Indeed, in London, the Bear Garden in Southwark, which had been there, of course, in Shakespeare's day, was replaced by a glassworks in the 1680s, while the travelling Edward Lord Harley visited the coal-fired salt pans at South Shields. Now, towns provided a setting for industrial development, not least as they offered transport, capital, demand, buildings, labour, and norms of economic activity. Their role as service centres sustained these valuable offerings to industry. So, Nottingham, for example, had a major pottery industry with the production of salt glazed stoneware starting between 1688 and 1693. Sheffield developed as a major centre of metallurgy. And the successive maps of Bristol, produced from 1673 on by James Millard, registered the growth of a key port and a major manufacturing centre, including of such products as refined sugar, soap, and glass. The castle had been demolished by the Cromwellian government in 1656, and that opened the way to new buildings on its site in Bristol. And this was the equivalent to the dissolution of major monastic sites, though less socially disruptive because it didn't affect social welfare and education. Subsequent maps of Bristol showed the erection of the corn market in 1684 and the changing use of the so-called Great House, which was one of the largest mansions. It was adapted to act as a manufactory in the 17th century, and in 1696 became the mint, and from then, because there was a recoinage that year, and then in 1697, the home of the pioneering Corporation of the Poor, a public workhouse and hospital, which represented an attempt to address public concern about poverty. I mean, indeed, Bristol replaced Norwich in about 1700 as England's second town. The rebuilding of towns became a more continuous process. So indeed, the corn market in Bristol, which I haven't mentioned, was erected in 1684, was demolished in the 1720s, the world of business digesting what had come before. Or Clarendon House, Piccadilly, a spectacular palace built in 1664 to 1667 for the Lord Chancellor, Edward I, Earl of Clarendon, father-in-law to James, Duke of York, was sold after the Earl's death in 1683 to bankers and merchants who demolished the house and developed the site. And more generally for London, Celia Fiennes, who travelled round England and wrote a very interesting diary, which has been published, recorded, "There was formerly in the city several houses of the noblemen with large gardens and outhouses, but of later pulled down and built into streets and squares and called by the names of the noblemen. And this is the practice by almost all." So I think I'm going to pause at that moment. We're slightly more optimistic than we were when we were looking in the aftermath of the Civil War. But one of the points I'm trying to make is there are different narratives that are possible. And I think that's an important point. It's all too easy for historians and other commentators, many of whom can be lazy, to think in terms of what Germans call a Zeitgeist, a spirit of the age, and try and accumulate ideas and practices in the age into a phrase, whatever it is, the age of revolution, the age of enlightenment, whatever. And then whatever doesn't fit into that account is treated as in some way an outlier. And of course, this is not helpful. Urban life, as I'm going to go on to continue to argue when we talk next, urban life is complex, as you'd expect. It is varied, as you'd expect. Individuals, communities, and groups within those communities had very different experiences, very different prospects, and very different expectations. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. I don't think anyone would accuse the Critic magazine of being with the zeitgeist, but at least I hope not. But I want to start by just picking up on one of the many issues you've covered, and that is the importance of a corporation and declining role of the guilds during this period of the late 17th and early 18th centuries. I wonder if you'd just say a little bit more about why the guilds went into decline.
Well, I think it's to do with free market economics, actually. I think you've got a degree of economic fluidity. You've got capital-intensive new manufacturing processes. I've mentioned, obviously, glass manufacturing or soap manufacturing, the early chemical industry, other ones, sugar refining. And these are not ones that are compatible with the existing guild structures. So you have guilds which often, they were still of, you were still manufacturing candles, for example. But that kind of process was becoming less typical of the range of economic activity. And I think it's fair to say that the regulatory mood is very much diminishes, particularly with the Glorious Revolution, which sees a more general attack on regulation. So an obvious one, since we're talking about the Critic magazine, is, as you probably know, the Licensing Act lapses, and you get, in effect, the end of pre-publication censorship, and you get an explosion in the press, and there's no guild for journalists, there's no guild for newspaper printers. You've got a new industry, and each time this happens, it makes existing arrangements seem more and more anachronistic. So that if you take external trade, there are some areas where there are very special requirements, notably those for fixed facilities in the case of what were known as factories, you know, bases that were fortified. So for the East India Company or for the Hudson Bay Company, so say Fort Churchill in, you know, on Hudson Bay, to protect the trade from, you know, from French attacks and indeed from possibly from Native Americans. But that is no longer the case for trade in Europe. And there is a move, very much a move in trade against this. Now, again, there are some areas in which regulation continues, very much continues. Markets within towns continue to be regulated. But again, if you're looking at that in the longer term, you'll be aware that in the 18th century, you have the rise of shopping, and shops are not regulated in the same way that markets are. So you're getting an economic series of changes in which pre-existing systems don't work so well. And if you want to think of a modern analogy, you can think of the way in which, I mean, obviously, the current government is going to try and turn the clock back, but you can think about the way in which trade union membership appeared in many areas of the economy to be increasingly irrelevant in over the last 20 years, and as that has also been the case in the United States.
A really, really interesting subject, and maybe one we should address free trade before Adam Smith another time. Because I think there's a lot to be explored there. Just one final question before we have to call time, and that is about the city walls, the town walls that went round towns, and as you said, you know, were either damaged or sometimes dismantled as a consequence of the civil wars. Were those city walls continued to circle towns and cities after the end of the Civil War period? Were they just dismantled piecemeal? Were they left where they were, but generally you know, builders came and stole a few bricks or stones at a time? Or was there, led by corporations, particular efforts to actually remove the city walls as part of a urban improvement plan?
Oh, it very much varied. I mean, for example, if you take Exeter, where the city walls had been damaged during the two sieges of the 1640s, most of the city wall remained extant. And in fact, it continued to make it remain extant, although subsequently the gates were removed in the early 19th century to ease traffic. But most of it remained extant until the 1960s and 70s, when the Western Bypass was put in. That did some damage, but there's still a lot of it there. So there wasn't necessarily a process of demolishing walls. But as I've said last time, some walls were removed or damaged. I cited Gloucester and Northampton last time because they backed the wrong side in the Civil War. And obviously, subsequently, there were moves against. But you see, walls had an advantage that they could segregate that area that was under the direct authority of a urban corporation and the area outside it. So that was significant. They could also, as it were, ensure the focus of traffic onto particular gates, if you wish to use those gates to in some way regulate what things were being brought in or out. And also walls could be a barrier against animals coming in. So there were reasons why walls could still be useful. But I think what's the key point is that there isn't a process of new walling to encompass suburbs that might develop.
No, indeed. Indeed, sir. Well, a fascinating episode on this history of towns as ever, Professor Jeremy Black. I've enormously enjoyed it, and thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.